invitation, I will spare you a repeat or an update of the previous talk that I've given on the direction that the leadership is going to take, because I frankly don't know. I'm probably as perplexed as you are about where the current leadership is going. It's in flux, it's moving too fast to follow properly. And also because the theme of your conference is about the nature and global implications of China's growth and development. And so I felt that either speaking about the leadership or about legal pluralism, which is something I'm still working on, would not totally address what you would like to talk about. And so I decided to prepare my interventions on the demographic challenges to growth and development in China. I'm aware that many of you are interested in the possibilities for investing in China or looking at what are the obstacles for continued economic relations between our two countries. So I felt that the issue of demography in China is not one that is often addressed, and it has some very important consequences. So in lieu of introduction, I will just read from my notes to make sure that I'm keeping with the time. So to start with, the rise of China's middle classes can easily lead to hyperboles. The number of people affected by the tremendous changes experienced by China's economy since the last three decades dwarfs the Western world's own process of industrialization. The scale of these transformations is unprecedented. And there is more to come if current rates of economic growth and urbanization remain the same. On the positive side, the rise of middle classes will contribute to the rebalancing of the world economy, as China may soon depend more on domestic consumption than export for its growth. However, the rise of middle classes in China will also affect the world economy in terms of supply and demand for natural resources and energy. The world is going into uncharted territory when we take into account the expansion of China's middle classes with concerns about its environmental sustainability as well as its effect on social and political stability. All the above predictions, of course, are predicated on the assumption that the growth rates of China's economy will stay high, that resources and energy supplies will remain available at fairly stable prices, or that technological solutions will be readily available to offset the environmental collateral damages of breakneck economic growth. A failure on each of these counts could be destabilizing politically. But even if the latter optimistic views on China's growth rate, technological solutions to environmental problems were to be confirmed, the rise of middle classes in China is likely to be influenced by important demographic trends that are already underway and are exercising their effects in ways that are affecting growth itself, as well as social and political stability. Although forecasting is always a perilous exercise, demographic changes have a degree of inertia to them that allows for fairly plausible predictions. So my talk will focus on three aspects of these changes in particular. First, the aging of China's population. Second, the skewed sex ratio of the population. And third, the continuation of the process of urbanization. So to start with the consequences of aging in China. China is going to experience a dramatic diminishing of its population growth in the coming decades. The WHO reckons that the decline of China's fertility rate, levels in just one decade of about 50% is unprecedented in history. Because of this diminishing of the growth of rate, not of population, but of the growth rate of population, China will be faced with an unbearable burden within the next 50 years caused by an unfavorable age dependency ratio. That is, the number of dependents, that is, the number of children and older persons, who need to be supported by every adult in the working age group. That level is going to rise. Problem is that China has not yet developed infrastructures to provide support for elderly care. It needs to establish the financial basis that will allow its elderly population to enjoy a decent retirement. This will present the Chinese authorities with an enormous financial burden as long-term care is more expensive and demanding. This is something we know in Canada and in most Western societies. One factor will complicate further the demographic equation within the next four decades. The aging of population may be somewhat offset by a reversal of life expectancy's improvement, as the environmental conditions of China, already dire in its largest cities, continue to deteriorate, jeopardizing the health of the most vulnerable generations. In addition to the chronic diseases generated by middle-class lifestyle, the increase in pollution affects the incidence of cancer and other forms of disease that are more expensive to treat. The current trends of aging in China are unlikely to change, even if the authorities were determined to reverse the more draconian features of their population policies. The aging of Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, where authorities have never adopted authoritarian population control policies, may represent the future of China. These affluent societies have seen extremely low levels of population growth for decades, and there are no indications that these trends could be reversed. The aging of East Asia appears to be lasting, and many demographers are expecting a decrease in population within the next four decades for all countries in the region. This decline would only marginally ease the pressure generated by the growth of middle classes, however, because consumption will likely continue to grow, and demand for healthcare services and elderly care will be more expensive. So I'll move now to the second demographic issue, the issue of skewed sex ratio and the at birth, that is, and the problem of what some have called bare branches. The traditional preferences for boys in China is aggravating the problem of aging by reducing the fertility rate of the population further, and the skewed sex ratio generated by this preference for the last 20 years is considered, again, by Chinese authorities as a potential source of social unrest. It's important to keep in mind that this is not foreign paranoia. This is something that is a big concern for Chinese authorities themselves. There are two dimensions to the sex ratio to keep in mind. Natural sex ratio at birth shows a slightly larger number of boys being born than girls, but higher infant mortality for boys and longer life expectancy for women affect the total sex ratio to such an extent that it leads to a slightly higher number of women to men in any given population in the older age cohort and for the whole population. Recent advances in technology, however, and in particular the availability of ultrasound devices that can help to know the sex of fetus, has combined with the traditional preference for boys to an increase in selective abortions targeting girls. Data from the Chinese government have shown a steady decline in the number of girls born to boys for more than two decades. The surplus of men relative to women presents many men at a marriageable age without the hope of establishing a family. The consequences of that gap could be catastrophic, according to some researchers. Large number of men without the possibility of having offspring, known in traditional China as bare branches, and living in a society where the value of raising a family is paramount, are likely to be affected adversely in their psyche and may turn into antisocial elements. Research by historians suggests that major upheaval in dynastic China has been partly related to such demographic imbalance. Of course, which had different causes. Two researchers studying the field that we call security demography, Dr. Hudson and Dan Bell, have argued that 80% of China's floating population is made of males below 35 years old without a prospect to found a family known as bare branches. They base grim prognostic about future political instability on the premise that because these cohorts of men will be unmarried and without progeny, they possess distinctive characteristics such as low levels of education, unemployment, and poverty, a proclivity towards violence, and a social behavior, and a tendency to abuse substance. Of course, some of the evidence presented by Hudson and Denbor is unquestionably disturbing, even though we can disagree with some of their implications that they are making. The sex ratio at birth in China stands outside the usual norm of 105 to 107 boys born for every 100 girls. They quote from the Chinese government's own record that the sex ratio at birth is approximately 119 in 2004, adding that some Chinese scholars claim it may be even higher at 121, and that in the island of Hainan, admittedly not a big province in China, it is as high as 135. Above the bare branches, they reckon that between 12% and 15% of young men in China will not be able to find a spouse and have children. By 2020, they believe that China will count around 28 million of these so-called bare branches. As a consequence, they predict that Chinese society will see an increase in crime rates, and in particular, women trafficking and prostitution. The demographer, I'm moving to a slightly more optimistic territory, the demographer Christopher Yamamoto does not deny that Asia, that China, is experiencing what he has called a gradual demographic masculinization of society. However, he looks at the situation from a more dynamic perspective. Skewed sex ratio at birth, he argues, depends on three interrelated factors: a traditional preference for sons in patriarchal societies, access to modern sex selection, and a pressure due to small family size. Yamamoto believes that China currently experiences a peak in its skewed sex ratio at birth, and it will eventually return to a more normal ratio. Still, the relationship between development and skewed sex ratio is a complex one. Close observation reveals that it is in the most developed regions that the sex ratio at birth is more skewed, so it's not a question of poverty. Hence, the economically advanced provinces of Guangdong and Jiangsu have registered the most skewed sex ratio at birth. If the findings of demographers such as Yamamoto hold true, the high degree of imbalance observed in Guangdong should subside because the gender imbalance is, in his view, untenable, making the hypothesis of a permanent surplus of men unlikely in the long term. Yet, this does not mean that the dire hypotheses of Hudson and Denbar should be discarded. Skewed sex ratio is already alarmingly high in some regions, and their effects may endure for years before gender imbalance at birth are corrected. They mention, in particular, along with many other scholars, that the spread of HIV/AIDS and sexually transmitted infections constitutes a major fallout of the skewed sex ratio, and it generates considerable worries for now and the future. Research has shown that the incidence of these diseases relates to the sexual behavior of these bare branches, who are more likely to seek the services of prostitutes and are more prone to engage in unprotected sex. This trend is worrisome because it does not relate to the usual segment of society considered at risk, such as intravenous users, but from the million of migrant workers who are unmarried, often unemployed, poor, uneducated, and moving across the country. Whether this relationship between skewed sex ratio and social instability is inaccurate or not, the gap between men and women cohorts in China worries the authorities. Again, I'm not making this up. This is something that the Chinese government is really concerned about. Chinese authorities are worried enough to implement a Care for Girl campaign aimed at stopping the deterioration of the sex ratio at birth and aiming at addressing the situation from 20 11 to 2015 before reaching the normal sex ratio at birth of 106 from 2016 to 2020. Chinese authorities and demographers worry that skewed sex ratios will prevent population growth, as there are slightly fewer households that can have children. In other words, just compounding the problem of the aging of the population that I mentioned before. So enough of this rather gloomy prognosis. There's a little ray of hope that the Chinese authorities are aware of that problem, that they are working now both to prevent its continuation, but also now they are really working hard to try to offset the effects of the existing skewed sex ratio. So the third problem, that is the third demographic issue that China is facing, is one like the two previous one that has some very important consequences, but it's also one that is really something that you really cannot control very much. I'm making reference, of course, to the issue of internal migration, and in particular, urbanization. Internal migrations, I briefly made remarks about internal migrations that can be destabilizing for other reasons than HIV rates increase, as I just mentioned before, with reference to the problem of bare branches. But the internal migrations can be destabilizing because they can trigger imbalance between regions, ethnic groups, and religious communities, and trigger unrest in the regions and the peripheries. But these sources of instability, they pale in comparison to the huge migrations within the area populated by Han Chinese. The expansion of middle classes, as I mentioned at the beginning, has already affected directly migration as millions, well, hundreds of millions of rural residents have left their impoverished countryside for economically more promising regions seeking opportunities. Such labor migrations in China have affected close to 200 million people who have moved to the coastal provinces close to three decades after the beginning of economic reform in 1978. Under the Hu-Wen administration, the policy of developing the western central China has started to alter that trend, and as a result, another additional 200 million migration has incurred increasingly within the internal region as rural residents move to cities within their own region. The ongoing migration to cities, in turn, by swelling further the size of middle classes, will be changing the patterns of consumption, increasing demands for natural resources and energy, and contribute to an aggravation of climate change. The latter will likely increase the incidence of several severe natural disasters that may provoke future population movements and tax further the resources of the state. In 2010, for example, over 100 million people in China have suffered the consequences of flood, drought, and severe storms. Of all the migratory patterns likely to affect regional and global politics, none is more important than the Chinese domestic trends of urbanization. China has crossed the threshold of urbanization in 2011, with 51% of its population living in cities. The McKinsey Global Institute expected that in 2025, China's rate of urbanization will reach 64% of its population. Among China's cities, two of them are already hyper cities of over 10 million people, and up to 10 others are megacities of over 8 million or more. Chinese authorities have been successful so far at limiting the growth of these cities at sustainable levels by encouraging the growth of smaller cities. Therefore, although the focus on urbanization tends to be on upper cities or on megapolises, most urban growth will occur in mid-sized cities. But the achievement of Chinese authorities will remain incomplete until they reform the draconian system of residence permits that limits the social and economic rights of migrant workers and their dependents. So I'll conclude here and just mention that the economic growth of China presents the world with enormous promises. The evolution of the country so far, the reasonable expectation that it will continue for the coming decades, point to the most impressive process of poverty alleviation in human history, yet reaching to this horizon within the next 3 to 4 decades will also mean going into uncharted territory. So the aging of society, an already complex issue in the West, may affect the country before the majority of its people get rich. Unless the currently skewed sex ratio is addressed, the prospects for further aging and the risk of social instability is more likely, with unpredictable consequences. Finally, assuming that the Chinese government successfully steers the country towards the path of a sustainable growth and welfare system, mitigating aging and providing stability, the sheer number of consumers will exercise enormous pressures on world energy and resource markets, as well as pose the risk of further aggravating the risk associated with climate change. It is to be hoped that the ability of the Chinese government to guarantee its population sufficient levels of prosperity will enhance the legitimacy that will make possible the implementation of hard choices.
Thank you very, very much, and I call now Dr. Ian Feldman.
Thank you, Peggy. It really is a privilege to be here. I have enjoyed the presentation so far enormously, and I want to build on them. I want to build on them by beginning with a couple of remarks. Isaac Asimov, science fiction writer, in one of his books talks about the impossibility of sustained cumulative growth rates. And in order to make his case, he says, imagine that somebody invested 1 cent in the year zero. And in 1985, at the time he was writing, the value of that cent would be $3.5 million. That's a lot of money, but it's a long time to wait for your payout. We can get our heads around that. But if you invested the cent at 6.5%, the value of that cent in 1985 would have been the weight of the sun in gold at then current market prices. But not only one sun. If a child had stood on a hilltop and watched the sky and 18,000 suns, new suns every minute had appeared, the weight of all those suns over a year would be the value of the penny. So people who talk about China's growth rate disastrously slowing to 7% are talking about things that are just not possible. And we need to start there. The second and somewhat related point, and very interesting presentation Andres just now, I very much appreciate those issues, but I always think, what would have happened to the world and global population if China had not had the one-child policy? I mean, people talk about that as if it's a big problem, but we also have this other problem, and we have to try and address all of them at the same time, and that's where we really have to start getting serious. My remarks, I want to build on the brilliant presentation that we got yesterday evening. I thought it was just the most marvelous beginning that we could have had. But I want to say that I absolutely appreciated and accepted the picture that Amar presented. But I want to suggest that one can interpret those numbers in a very different way. And that's really the central theme of what I want to say. The main focus of this conference was to be the impact of external policies on China. Now, we understand that China is a world unto itself. It's an economy, it's a society that is phenomenally self-centered, that has its own dynamic, and nobody should think, and I wouldn't dream of suggesting, that these external policies will be the determining driving force. But I do think we, particularly in the Western world, need to think about the kinds of policies that we should support vis-a-vis China and those that we should be more skeptical about. And the central problem is that our policies towards China, in my view, are both deeply misguided and ultimately dangerous. Our policies to China are schizophrenic, sometimes almost humorously so. On one hand, we put enormous pressure on China, we seek to put enormous pressure on China to promote continuing economic liberalization, to promote financial liberalization, to limit efforts towards industrial policy within China. The U.S. has been extremely aggressive within the WTO in seeking to nip in the bud any evidence that China is beginning to try to address the question of building domestic industrial capabilities that are nationally rooted. And of course, we push very, very hard for moves towards liberal democracy and for more empowerment of minorities. And then in the wings, in the background, and increasingly problematic, I think, is a development which suggests that, particularly in the U.S., preparations are afoot to deal with China as a potential military threat. In fact, a recent report, quite dramatic, says that in the U.S. military now, the core strategic focus of the U.S. military is, quotation marks, a future war with China. So we have those foreign policies, which are kind of rooted in the notion that here is China, it is authoritarian, it is dangerous, it is not playing by the rules, we must force it to play by the rules. And then there's the other side of our foreign policy, which is the side that reflects the fact that we ourselves are in economic disarray, and so we send trade mission after trade mission to China and focus very, very strongly, particularly in this country now, on investment opportunities and market access. I would like to suggest that this approach of ours is potentially disastrous. It fails to understand the challenges facing China, and it fails to understand the challenges facing us. The challenges facing China, and some of them have been talked about very eloquently, social tension related to rising inequality, related to regional differences, related to increasing potential economic instability, related, as Professor Scher indicated at one point, the danger of financial instability, which is, I would say, ever-present, the dangers of environmental degradation, the challenge of sustaining the wage increases that we are now seeing, and this is where I'll come to that in a moment. I take a slightly different view from the one Amar put on the table yesterday. And the struggle within China to sustain the legitimacy of a government, which has been very, very effective. I attended a session not long ago where a journalist, very well-known journalist, who had traveled all around China, gave a presentation, and it was a long list, a litany of stories, anecdotes, showing how corrupt, how misguided, how alienated Chinese people were. And at the end of the presentation, I remember getting up and saying, well, those stories are all interesting, and I'm sure they're, and many of them are very poignant, but I wondered, had he ever given any thought to the question how it is that China, for the past 35 years now, has been by far the most successful economy in the world. And he literally had nothing to say. He kind of mumbled and said, yes, yes, he had something about that in his notes, but he didn't get around to it. So China faces challenges, but it faces challenges from a situation which is its own reality. We may judge it this way, or we may judge it that way. Most people wish they were so lucky to have those problems. And what are the challenges that we face in our part of the world? Well, funnily enough, the list is almost exactly the same. We face social tensions connected to inequality, rising inequality, a declining legitimacy of governments. I would say that the democratic process in some of our countries, certainly south of the border and even in our own country, I think the political well has been poisoned to a very extensive degree. We also face environmental issues, and as Amar reminded us yesterday, in fact, we have done far less about the environment than China has, which is a pretty sobering observation. I said China will have to address the challenge of sustaining rising wages. But what about our societies? The earnings, not only the wages, the earnings, despite longer hours, the earnings of full-time white male production workers in the United States are lower today than they were in 1974. Imagine that. That when I began studying these issues, such as, in fact, I did project such possibilities, and whenever one did that, one was treated as a complete and absolute lunatic. But that's the reality. And financial instability, I guess I don't need to say much about that, except to say that's a challenge facing us big time. What I want to put on the table for consideration, and I obviously can't begin to try to do justice to this argument, but I want to suggest that neither China's ability to deal with its problems in its own way and our ability to address our problems as they need to be addressed cannot happen unless we shift from the current economic trajectory, the insistence on continual liberalization of markets, liberalization of finance. We need to join some of the BRIC countries, and China, in fact, is talking about those issues now, to rebuild a new Bretton Woods system that will allow a different relationship between the market and society. Amar was very good yesterday because towards the end of his remarks he said, yes, the issue is not big states versus little states, it's smart states. I absolutely agree. But the question is, what does that mean? How do smart states behave? And here, very, very sketchily, I will just present you with a very brief capsule of how I interpret the recent period of history and the lessons that I think we need to draw both for ourselves and for China. And the upshot of all that, of course, is that we must absolutely stop pushing China in a direction that will only make it more and more difficult for it to deal with those problems that it confronts. And at the same time will allow us to begin to address problems that we have neglected and have taken us to a situation that none of us could have dreamed of. I did my thesis many years ago on the impact of technological change on labor. And at the end of that, as I discussed the way in which working hours had changed over time with changing technology, I eventually came to the conclusion that the one thing which the market economy was least likely to deliver on was the dream of what was then called the leisure society. And let me just remind you of what that was about. And it was believed almost universally. And the idea was that, well, here's capitalism, it's very dynamic, it improves productivity, it improves our lives, and as workers become more affluent, well, of course, they will take more and more of their share of the benefits in the form of leisure. And we had wall-to-wall conferences discussing how we'd have to restructure our universities so they would become less jobs-focused and they could prepare people for this life of leisure. The rubber workers of Akron, Ohio had recently negotiated the first four-day work week. Akron, Ohio is now a ghost town, and the four-day work week is something people can't even get their heads around. And the question we have to ask is, why did that not happen? It wasn't because technology didn't deliver. It was because the power relationships got skewed to such a degree that we are now in the thrall of a system that is intent on generating profits, generating returns, and in fact generating returns for a bloated, inflated financial system that is irresponsible, irrational, unaccountable. And by the way, if these are big issues, Google The Future of Finance. It's a book published, it was for the longest time it was available free on the internet, published by London School of Economics. The chief author is a former financial regulator in the UK. And if you read this book, you will understand, I believe, that the claim that the financial system is a huge contributor to our welfare and to growth is absolutely spurious. The incomes generated in the financial system have nothing to do with productivity or with welfare gains. They are statistical artifacts reflecting increased risk. And we know about the consequences of that risk. Well, let me very quickly conclude by saying that the world was once different. And we need to understand why that was, and we need to find a way, and it's going to be very, very difficult from here to get back to the conditions that allowed the world to be different. And to make that point, I will start, first thing let me say, when the Second World War came to a close, everybody, the vast majority of experts, expected the post-war era to be extremely unstable and difficult. Britain was bankrupt, Western Europe was in a shambles, the preponderance of U.S. power was unprecedented. People thought back of the horrendous aftermath of the First World War, and they absolutely expected that the post-war period would be very, very difficult and dangerous. And then what happened was the world was lucky enough to put together an international framework which allowed, as it turned out, the world to experience 25 years, a quarter century, of the most unprecedentedly stable, rapid growth in output and productivity. 1948 to 1973. I think it's appropriate to call that period the golden age of capitalism. But what was far more important about that period is that that rapid growth was associated with absolutely widespread benefits. The graph that's on the screen right now shows the increase of household incomes in the United States, real household incomes after inflation, by quintile. The column closest to me is the poorest 20%, the next poorest, the middle 20%, the next richest, the top 20%, and to the very far end, the top 5%. And what you see is that growth was distributed absolutely across society. Now, Mary, if you would put up the next slide. And now, leave the first version where all three sections are visible, or scroll up. Okay, so the first one, yes, please, go further. Okay. Now these two graphs show what happened in the next quarter century. They show that real household income increase was very low, and what there was distributed in an absurdly skewed manner, so that almost all of it accrued to the top 20% and indeed to the top 5%. And the after-tax picture is worse. And if we extended these numbers to the current situation, well, then we have the Bush tax cuts, and we have the crazy events surrounding the 2008 crisis. It is a picture which is, to put it mildly, sobering. But even this picture, and actually let's look at the other graphs, Mary, if you could go to the next graph. This really tells the same story. The two bottom lines are the incomes of the poorest 20% and of the median, and the top line are the incomes of the upper income groups. And now finally the fourth slide. This one really I find breathtaking. This shows the share of income accruing to the top 1%. And you see on the very left is 1929, and then comes the golden age, and then on the right is the current situation. Now those graphs are striking, in fact I think they're breathtaking, but they don't even tell half the story. They only focus on incomes. And behind those incomes, behind that golden age increase of incomes that occurred across the board, you had all manner of other socially human improvements. You had shorter working hours, you had improved working conditions, you had better social protection, you had a strong build-up of infrastructure, social infrastructure, economic infrastructure in society. The world is complicated. Time is short. Why did all this happen? Well, Keynes was absolutely a central figure in creating the institutions that allowed that golden age to happen, and at the center of Keynes' thinking, and I'll just leave you with some of these thoughts, was the idea, and this is I share completely, a market is a powerful, potentially positive instrument of social organization. It has been historically progressive. It has the capacity to improve our lives. But it only will do any of those things if it is embedded in a framework which has to be socially and politically constructed. The market as such, competitive forces alone, are not efficient. They are not desirable, they do not promote human welfare. In fact, the World Bank, in its 1989 World Development Report, says, with some prescience, but also some gall, given the policies they were promoting, it says that we should remember that excessively deregulated financial markets, quote, have a tendency towards instability and fraud. Yes, ain't that the truth? And in order for markets to be embedded, they were embedded in that period. And the key, in Keynes's mind, the key issue was the issue of capital controls. Keynes said, unless the rate of interest is nationally determined, no society can address its own particular social agenda or social policies. Because the rate of interest is a proxy for the average rate of profit, and the average rate of profit isn't a technical number. It's not a number that just reflects the scarcity of capital and the productivity of the capital. It's a number that reflects all kinds of decisions such a society has made about the importance of different claims to be made on the income that's generated. And of course, the other thing about that golden age if it was absolutely financially stable. The World Bank did a study in the 1990s, Joseph Stiglitz cites it, where they show that between 1947 and 1974, by their definition, there was not one single serious banking crisis in the world. And between 1974 and 1992, which was the end of the period that they were studying, there were 69. Mm-hmm. And since then, 690 maybe. What we need then, in order for China to address the many challenges that it faces, in order for us, I would put it, to regain the dream of the leisure society, we need to restore a system in which capital is allowed to play a central role, but is forced to play that role in a politically and socially defined context that allows different interests and different priorities to be addressed. Because the interesting thing about those graphs, they happen to be all about the United States, but you could draw similar graphs for every industrial country. They would not be as extreme, but they would show exactly the same contrasting experiences. And let me conclude by making a final plea for the leisure society. You see, the point is that as a society becomes more affluent, materially affluent, it is logical. In fact, it is, to me, inevitable, it should be inevitable, that in such a society, the objective of efficiency should become relatively less important. Society has many objectives. In the beginning, efficiency has to be, should be, a very, very high priority because you are trying to lay the foundations, you are trying to create conditions in which life can become more pleasant, more predictable, more fulfilling. But once you have laid those material foundations, then it is right that society should move forward and that priority becomes less important than other priorities. Building stable communities. Reconstructing work. The leisure society, you rightly laughed when I talked about it, the leisure society is history now in terms of the students that I was dealing with at the end of my career. They were going into a world where even the dream of a steady job with some career prospects and benefits was increasingly treated as some kind of idealistic fantasy. But behind that, there's another whole level of debate which has got completely lost. And that's the debate which used to say, well, at some point, work should come to be constructed increasingly, not in a way that gives primary emphasis to efficiency, increasingly in a way that thinks about how interesting the work is, how fulfilling the work is. Work should become less stressful. Well, in order for those things even to become conceivable, we have to step outside of the framework that we have now created. We have a government, I've read these documents to my students, that issues documents that say, well, of course, we'd like to support steady jobs with benefits, but unfortunately, that's just not possible. Competitiveness rules, and therefore, we are, quote, forced to promote the casualization of labor and to promote jobs where there are no benefits, where we're storing up huge problems for the near future. Our foreign policy to China needs to change in ways that reflect the way our own policies need to change, and only then can we hope that China can address its problems and we can address our problems.